Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The aftermath. Police search for a motive behind the July 4th parade shooting that has shaken the community of Highland Park, Illinois. Then, the climate question. The Supreme Court's decision opposing the authority of the Environmental Protection Agency raises questions about whether the U.S. can effectively fight climate change. And the cost of war. Ukrainian refugees across Europe struggle with the psychological trauma caused by the Russian invasion.
I've never felt this way before, when you don't know what's going to happen like in a month, or what you're going to do with your life, where you're going to go.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. A seventh person has died from the mass shooting in Highland Park, Illinois. Police are charging the gunman with multiple counts this evening. Officials said today that the 21-year-old pre-planned the July 4th attack for several weeks. Nearly 40 other people were injured after the suspect fired over 70 rounds of ammunition during a holiday parade. While the community grieves, law enforcement is still trying to determine a motive. Lisa Desjardins begins our coverage with this report.
The scene of chaos yesterday allegedly came from a calculated plan weeks in the making. Police in Illinois today released more information about Robert Bobby Cremo, the 21-year-old accused of carrying out yesterday's deadly mass shooting. Officials say he used an AR-15-style rifle, with a second one found with him when he was arrested, plus other handguns at his residence. All were bought legally and locally, but authorities provided no other details on how. Deputy Chief Christopher Cavelli said the gunman climbed onto a roof via a fire escape before shooting down on the crowd.
During the attack, Cremo was dressed in woman's clothing, and investigators do believe he did this to conceal his facial tattoos and his identity and help him during the escape with the other people who were fleeing the chaos.
Authorities said concern about the suspect was raised twice in 2019, a suicide attempt, which was handled by mental health officials, and separately, a threat to his family.
A family member reported that Cremo said he was going to kill everyone, and Cremo had a collection of knives. The police responded to his residence. The police removed 16 knives, a dagger, and a sword from Cremo's home. At that time, there was no probable cause to arrest.
Today, the parade route was behind police lines, still scattered with abandoned belongings of those who fled in terror. The scene joined a bloody collage. A church, school, and grocery store all have been recent sites of mass murder. This time, it was the heavily Jewish Chicago suburb of Highland Park that was terrorized by gun violence. Police said the shooter's motive was still unclear.
We have no information to suggest at this point it was racially motivated by religion or any other protected status.
Witnesses described a community shattered.
Everyone's pretty shaken. I think you're used to hearing about this stuff elsewhere, but it definitely hits a lot harder when, you know, it's not only your hometown, but it's also like right in front of you.
The ages of those killed or wounded spanned from 8 to 85. Among the dead, 78-year-old Nicholas Toledo, grandfather with 8 children. He was visiting his family, who described him as their guardian angel. Another victim, Jackie Sundheim, a teacher and lifelong member of a nearby synagogue. The congregation said her warmth and kindness touched them all. Also killed, victims named today were Irina and Kevin McCarthy, parents to a surviving 2-year-old, 64-year-old Catherine Goldstein, and 88-year-old Stephen Strauss. The accused gunman who unleashed the chaos had a history of glorifying mass murders on far-right internet forums. The United States has seen at least 315 mass shootings this year, defined as 4 or more people injured or shot. At the White House, flags flew at half-staff to mourn a tragic, and now very familiar, American Day. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
Let's go to Highland Park now to hear more about how that community is coping and the questions surrounding this shooting. Nancy Rotering is the mayor, and she joins me now. Madam Mayor, thank you for being here. And you do have our deepest condolences. We know that a seventh person has died. Well over 30 people wounded. Can you tell us any more about those who are still in the hospital?
The folks who are still in the hospital have a broad range of injuries, and they are scattered throughout regional hospitals. So we are obviously trying to respect the terror and sadness that their families are experiencing right now and trying to give them their space, but understand that, you know, this was a weapon of war meant to destroy human life. And so people are dealing with a broad range of injuries.
And what about the people in your community? How are they doing?
We are in deep, deep mourning. Yesterday was more of a matter of shock and disbelief that this had actually happened in our community. Today, it is a day of just sheer sadness. Wherever I go, we're hugging, we're crying, and people are in so much pain right now.
Mayor Roetering, we've just learned that among the victims were both parents of a two-year-old child. What do you know about this and what's being done for that family?
That, to me, was one of the most heartbreaking stories of yesterday. My understanding is that the baby was retrieved from underneath his father and was carried to safety. We spent hours trying to locate the parents, and when it became clear that nobody was asking about the child, I suspected the worst. He is safely with his grandparents. There are two efforts to assist all of the victims of this situation. They're both available on our city website's front page.
Well, we can only imagine yet another incident like this. Madam Mayor, we watched the news conference that you and the police officers, officials had a short time ago, and we understand that there were two encounters with the suspect in 2019, one in the spring of that year after he attempted suicide. His family contacted police, no charges. Then again, later that year, where there were knives, a sword, and so forth. Again, no charges, but police were made aware. Should more have been done in 2019?
I'm confident that what the police did was within their capabilities under the law. We did notify the Illinois State Police in the 2019 event, and we'll leave it at that. But there's, you know, we need to talk about the fact that so many people in this country who should not have access to guns are having access to guns, and that's an issue that's unique to the United States. We know that throughout the world, people have mental illness, they have anger issues. They don't have access to these large capacity magazines and weapons that are frankly used in combat.
And that's what I want to ask you about, because these weapons he used apparently, we're still getting information, but they were apparently obtained legally. He's 21 years old. It begs the question, I mean, this is a community, Highland Park, Illinois, where they're relatively tough gun control laws on the books, and yet he was able to get these guns and do this.
Right. And so within our assault weapons ban and large capacity magazine ban, he obviously broke that law. But the problem is, throughout our country, there aren't very many communities that are banning these combat weapons. We need to have a national approach that says this is not part of what a civilized society has on its streets. We represented the values of our community and did what we could within the confines of the law. I've been in touch with the governor. I've been in touch with the Senate president and the House speaker. We need to change legislation in Illinois, but frankly, we need to change legislation in the United States. We're surrounded by states with very lenient gun laws. And so we are doing our part as much as we can, but we as a country need to come together and say, enough with the carnage. This is an almost weekly event. And I heard from several mayors yesterday who they themselves had been through this experience. There's a handbook that's sent to mayors in the wake of a mass shooting. That's unbelievable to me that this is what happens to a community who only wants to gather to celebrate freedom and ends up dealing with basically this horror on our hands.
I hear you saying this, Madam Mayor, and yet the Congress, as you know, just passed a law last week. They were applauded for finally coming together to do something. And just today, the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell is saying the problem is mental health, and it does appear to be an issue in this shooting. But clearly that's not enough. I mean, these shootings are still happening on a regular basis.
And let's pose the argument that there are people with mental health issues in other countries that do not have to endure this kind of violence on a weekly basis. So, Mitch, you're right. We do need to put more resources towards mental health care. But there's a second prong, and that is diminishing access to weapons that are used in combat.
Highland Park Mayor Nancy Rotering, and again, our deep condolences to you and your entire community. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Judy.
In the day's other news, in Ukraine, the governor of Donetsk is urging the 350,000 remaining residents to evacuate from the last eastern province that is still partly under government control as Russian troops step up their offensive. Meanwhile, a new wave of Russian shelling pounded the cities of Slovyansk and Kramatorsk, hitting residential areas and a market. We'll have more on all this later in the program. NATO's 30 nations signed accession protocols today for Finland and Sweden to join the alliance, but each country's legislature still needs to ratify the membership bids. Turkey's government said that it might refuse if the two countries fail to meet their demands to extradite people they perceive to be terror suspects. NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg urged allies to move swiftly.
With 32 nations around the table, we will be even stronger, and our people will be even safer as we face the biggest security crisis in decades.
If ratified, the move would be the most significant expansion of NATO in decades, further isolating Russia from the West. In Australia, more than 50,000 people in and around Sydney are now under evacuation orders or warnings amid a flood emergency that has left hundreds of homes completely inundated. Several days of torrential rain have flooded roads, submerged entire neighborhoods, and caused waterways to overflow, leaving residents in disbelief.
We've been here 25 years, and this year it's been the worst. We've had three major floods in 3 years, and it's just been shocking.
Absolutely devastated. It's really hard. So we don't know. We're just doing one day at a time, getting through it.
Weather forecasters say they expect that the rain will subside by tomorrow. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing more political pressure today after two of his top cabinet ministers resigned. Treasury Chief Rishi Sunak and Health Secretary Sajid Javid quit, citing Johnson's lack of integrity, they said. Their resignations came as Johnson, who narrowly survived a no-confidence vote just last month, apologized for appointing a lawmaker to a top position in spite of sexual misconduct claims. Back in this country, the special grand jury investigating former President Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 election results in Georgia has subpoenaed his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, and Republican U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham. Subpoenas were also issued to members of the Trump legal campaign legal team. It marks a new phase in this probe as prosecutors seek testimony from Mr. Trump's inner circle. And stocks were mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 129 points to close at 30,968. The NASDAQ rose 194 points, and the S&P 500 added six. Still to come on the NewsHour, the family of a black man in Ohio who was shot dozens of times by police demands accountability. Russian forces set their sights on new targets after a key victory in eastern Ukraine. A deaf actor challenges musical theater norms by starring in The Music Man, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The Supreme Court's recent decision to limit the authority of the Environmental Protection Agency has many worried about whether the Biden administration can reach its climate goals. The president had pledged that by 2030, the country would reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 50% from 2005 levels. That now seems even more unlikely. Amna Nawaz has more.
That's right, Judy. The court ruled 6-3 that the Clean Air Act does not give the EPA blanket regulations against power plants. Many environmentalists see the ruling as a serious setback in the fight to address the climate crisis and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I'm joined now by Michael Oppenheimer. He's a professor of geosciences and international affairs at Princeton University. He's one of the six scientists who filed an amicus brief in the Supreme Court case. And Mustafa Santiago Ali, who formerly worked in the EPA's Office of Environmental Justice and is now with the National Wildlife Federation. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us. Michael Oppenheimer, the ruling clearly leaves the administration with far fewer tools to fight the climate crisis, but the EPA administrator and other administration officials insist they can still meet their goals. It'll just take a little longer. Do you buy that?
That's a very optimistic view. And even under an optimistic view, this decision is going to seriously slow U.S. progress in reducing emissions of the greenhouse gases and avoiding a dangerous climate change. What I mean by dangerous is more, much more of the kinds of weather we've already started to see: record heat, record drought, sea level rise, flooding coastal areas, and really intense rainstorms, in some cases drowning people in their own bedrooms. So what was the government going to do about that? Well, Congress, number one, could act, and number two, the administration could develop regulations in the absence of congressional action. Because Congress has been so deadlocked by polarization, the administration, and in fact, administrations going back to the Obama administration, started developing regulations. That whole process was slowed by and disrupted by the Trump administration. The Biden administration had a very good plan that looked like it might get us on the track to avoiding dangerous climate change. I'm afraid that this decision will disrupt that possibility for the U.S. and for the world.
Mustafa Ali, let me ask you about the danger that Michael Oppenheimer just mentioned there, the consequences of this ruling. When you're talking about the stakes, when you're talking about the communities who are worst impacted, most directly impacted by things like rulings like this, who are we talking about?
We're talking about African-American communities. We're talking about Latinx communities, Asian and Pacific Islanders, indigenous brothers and sisters, and also lower wealth white communities, who, because of previous policy, have often been placed in sacrifice zones. And when we look at where these coal-fired power plants are located, they're usually located close to our most vulnerable communities, thereby impacting their health, extracting wealth from those communities. And at the same time, we know that our communities are hit first and worst, so we have to deal with all of the climate crises that were just mentioned.
Mustafa, you grew up in West Virginia, not too far from a coal power plant. What did you see growing up that informed your view today?
Well, right across the river, we had an old coal-fired power plant. And when the winds would shift, the emissions would blow into our community, which was up higher than the community across the river. And we had cancers. My family has had multiple cancers. My best friend's mother and grandmother died of cancer throughout our community. We had multiple cancers, really a cancer cluster, if you will. We never had an analysis done because we didn't have the language or the things that were necessary at that time. But others across the country have found these direct correlations between the burning of fossil fuels, both things like sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, mercuries, and PM2.5 particulate matter, all of these things having huge impacts in our country. And we should pay attention, because we have over 200,000 people who are dying prematurely right now from air pollution in our country. So when the Supreme Court makes this decision, it is also adding the burden onto these communities. And we know we've got 24 million people with asthma and 7 million kids. And disproportionately, it is African American and Latin children who are the ones who are going to the emergency rooms, and the ones who are losing their lives. That's the reason we have to act now.
So, Michael, when it comes to that action, you mentioned you don't see much hope in Congress acting, though they do retain the authority to do something. When it comes to the administration, this ruling doesn't say that the EPA can't regulate the emissions. It just says they have to find a different set of tools to do so, right? So what could the administration be doing right now?
I think anything the administration tries to do, they'll be right back in court, and the case will have to work its way up to the same Supreme Court, which has shown itself to be antithetical to the idea of dealing with climate change. So what really the possibilities are at the state level, where a lot of states have moved forward. The trouble with that route is some of it is also dependent on Clean Air Act authority, and the same fossil fuel interests and others that don't want to see this problem solved are going to be going and suing the states. Beyond that, there is the possibility of industry itself taking the lead, voluntary action. For instance, the auto industry may say, we're going to move ahead with electrification of motor vehicles anyway. The solar energy industry may up its investments, but that isn't going to be enough. You need either tough laws from Congress or tough regulations from the administration to be able to get this done quickly enough. And I'm afraid things are just going to be slowed down until there's a different view among not just the Congress, but the judiciary as well.
Michael, do you believe this makes it harder for the U.S. to actually push other nations, other major emitters like India and China, to act?
Some countries like China, I think, are going to go ahead and do what they were going to do anyway, more or less regardless of what we're doing. Europe, if it doesn't get if its whole energy system isn't thrown into disarray by the war in Ukraine, may in the end be able to continue the road it was on towards deeply cutting emissions, for instance, of carbon dioxide, the major human-made greenhouse gas. Mm-hmm. But there are countries like India, for instance, that haven't decided which way they're going to go. I think those countries may be seriously affected by the U.S. lack of inertia in the right direction on this issue. And so we'll have to see. But I'm very worried about it right now.
Mustafa Ali, I'll give you the last word here in the few seconds we have left. I don't hear much hope there from Michael Oppenheimer. What about you? Do you think that there's hope ahead for meaningful action to address this climate crisis here?
I do. My grandmother says you have power unless you give it away. So we should be raising our voice. There's $550 billion that's sitting right now on Capitol Hill. We need Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema and the Biden administration and all the Republican brothers and sisters to come together and do the right thing and make sure that we are actually have a just transition, that we are making the investments that are necessary around a clean economy, and that we are lowering emissions. So if we can get those dollars in place, we can help the states and counties and cities who have been doing incredible work to have what they need for this long journey that we have in front of us to address the climate crisis. And then we can also make sure that we utilize our vote and make sure that we are voting in those who care about our communities and those who want to see a brighter and more sustainable future.
That is Mustafa Santiago Ali and Michael Oppenheimer joining us tonight. My thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Protests erupted last night in Akron, Ohio. Despite a citywide curfew, dozens were arrested. This came 1 week after the fatal police shooting of 25-year-old Jaylen Walker, an unarmed black man. Hundreds of protesters demanded justice after the release of body camera video showed officers in pursuit, followed by a hail of bullets. Walker sustained more than 60 wounds. Stephanie Tsai has details.
Judy, the family of Jaylen Walker is calling for peace amid the protests, but they also want answers and accountability from the police. To tell us more about what justice would look like for the family is Bobby DiCello, a member of the legal team representing Jaylen Walker's family. We have also asked for an interview with the mayor and police chief. Bobby DiCello, thank you for joining the NewsHour. The overall narrative from the police chief in Akron is that police believe Jaylen Walker fired a gun when he was in his vehicle and that officers feared he would fire again. They gunned him down. We've seen the disturbing videos. We now know he was unarmed when police opened fire. My first question is, have you seen or heard evidence to the contrary?
Have I seen evidence to the contrary? Yes, in that the police account right now is something that is very, very concerning to us. There is evidence that the gun was not found in the front seat. According to the preliminary autopsy report that my team reviewed, there was evidence that the gun was found in the back seat. There is some concerning questions about the nature and quality of the video that is being used to substantiate some kind of flash. And whether or not the door was open, I challenge anyone to crack open their door while going 60 miles an hour and try to point it at a police officer without sticking your hand out the window or firing it through the or out the side of the door. So we have some serious questions about some of these allegations, and we're going to get to the bottom of it.
Bobby, what can you say about how the Akron Police Department has handled this case so far? And I want to go back to the chase itself, because this all started as an alleged traffic violation or some sort of vehicle violation. There's been some question about why this even ended up as a chase.
There should be a huge question as to why this ended up as a chase. That's one of the most outrageous facts of this case, is that there was a chase. It's outrageous that they chased this man, and it's outrageous that they gunned him down with more than 90 bullets and more than 60 striking his body. Look, there was a guy yesterday that opened fire on people in, in a park, and he was approached. If you saw the video, he was approached with pleas and thank yous and let's do this, and he was put on the ground. My client was running away from the police when he was shot at, both from behind and from the side and from the front. It is a totally different treatment for Black Americans in this country.
Well, I want to talk about that. And of course, you're referring to the Highland Park shooter. And I want to ask you about racial bias, because statistically, Black people are about 3.5 times more likely than whites to be killed by police when they are not attacking and when they are unarmed, which was the case again when Jaylen Walker was actually killed. There are questions about whether police knew he was unarmed when they killed him. But do you think ultimately, Bobby, this is sadly another data point proving racial bias of some kind?
I hope it's not just another data point proving racial bias. I hope this case gives us the pause to consider the value of every American life. And I hope it causes law enforcement at the city of Akron to do two things immediately. Get dash cams. Do you know that not one car has a dash cam on it in that city as we speak right now? That's unbelievable in 2022. And the second thing they have to do is they have to revise their chase and their firearms policies. There were 8 officers that shot my client as he was running away, and we have to address both of those things immediately.
Jaylen was only 25, and I read that he worked at DoorDash. And up until this incident, he had no criminal record. I also read that he'd recently lost his fiancée in a horrible car accident. Why is it important for us to remember his humanity as we look at this case? And what else can you tell us about who he was?
What a beautiful question. His humanity is what we are. We are all a collective American family. There is no need to divide ourselves anymore. And there's no need to take this case into the spotlight as an example of another Black life lost, unless we ignore that another Black life was lost. So we have to confront the issues that this case highlights. Look, the way men are treated who are African American is documented to be different. And we have to deal with that from a law enforcement perspective.
Bobby DiCello, a lawyer for Jaylen Walker's family, thank you so much for joining the NewsHour.
Thank you for having me.
After more than 4 months of intense fighting, Russia has claimed victory over one of the 2 provinces in Ukraine's eastern industrial heartland. But that victory comes at a steep price, with Russian forces suffering heavy losses. Nick Schifrin brings us up to date.
They made a wasteland and called it victory. Russian state television showed off its soldiers' handiwork in Lysychansk, a city that had to be destroyed to be captured. Journalists who entered with Russian forces filmed the symbols of Ukrainian governance gutted and overturned. But also the humanitarian center, volunteers say, was hit by 50 bombs. The market, where civilians shopped. The church, where they prayed in the same language as their Russian tormentors. Residents no choice but to switch their loyalties east.
What am I going to do? I'm going to see my kids who are in Russia. That's all for now. Hopefully, I stay alive.
And now Moscow's on to the next urban target. Today, a market in Slovyansk, where the mayor warned residents to evacuate. An apartment complex in Bakhmut, all doors and windows blown out by the Russian rocket whose remnants remain on the street. Over the weekend, Russian forces captured Lysychansk, the final Ukrainian-held city in Luhansk. That allows them to focus on the parts of the Donetsk region they don't already occupy, including today's targets Slovyansk, Bakhmut, and Kramatorsk. That's where scores of residents lined up outside the humanitarian center to pick up food. It's run by Jose Andres' humanitarian organization, World Central Kitchen. Each bag, enough provisions for a month for those who've stayed. 83-year-old Valentina has nowhere else to go.
I'm not going anywhere. We have no money to go anywhere. What will be. If they kill me, they kill me.
Yesterday, Russian President Vladimir Putin declared victory in Luhansk, but also hinted the next phase could have to wait.
The units that took part in active hostilities and achieved success, victory in the Luhansk direction, of course, should rest and increase their combat capabilities.
But Russia may have no other choice. Some Western artillery is arriving in eastern Ukraine, giving Ukrainian soldiers more accuracy and mobility. It's an artillery war, as American Isaac saw up close.
It's incredibly intense. I would say that it probably resembles World War II more than it does any of the more recent conflicts.
Isaac, who requested we use only his first name, has been fighting with Ukraine's International Legion. He filmed this video in Severodonetsk as they came under artillery fire. He's now temporarily back in the U.S.
The artillery is both incessant, and on the Russian side, it's also indiscriminate. There are cities that don't exist in the practical sense of the word. There are no services. The infrastructure is completely destroyed.
You served in Iraq. You served in Afghanistan with the U.S. military. What's the difference?
We were the big guys. We had significant material assets. In this case, the tables are turned. In this case, we are outmanned and outgunned.
And why are you going to go back?
The atrocities and the level of disregard for the rules of war that I've seen the Russians do. And I've also been inspired by the courage of the Ukrainian forces.
Ukraine now estimates that what the Russians have done will cost $750 billion to reconstruct. That's five times the country's GDP, and is also the GDP of Switzerland, where this week European leaders pledged to help the country recover.
They want to undermine Ukraine's very existence as a state. We cannot and we will never let that happen.
And to discuss the state of war in Ukraine, we turn once again to Michael Kaufman, Research Program Director in the Russia Studies Program at the Center for Naval Analyses. Michael Kaufman, good to have you back on the program. What's the significance of Russian forces seizing all of the Luhansk region?
Well, like with those two main cities, now that they have the rest of the region, they're at least part of the way towards their political objective, which is seizing the entire administrative territory of the Donbas. However, a lot of the harder fighting is still ahead for the Russian military. The Ukrainian military conducted a withdrawal from that area, and they are now building a new defensive line. They are going to fortify around the main cities of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. And so, while you could say that Russia has made incremental or fitful progress, it's still very far short of their actual political goals so far in this war.
So short term, Russia's ability to seize those territories in the Donetsk region, Slovyansk, Kramatorsk, why will it be difficult for them to do that just in the short term?
Well, those areas are more fortified, and the Russian military, like the Ukrainian military, has taken very substantial losses. So this has become a grinding war of attrition. Territorial gains tend to be incremental at best. And they require a tremendous amount of use of artillery and other types of fire. So I suspect that we're going to see battles grind on in the Donbas at least the next month or two. The outcome, of course, is indeterminate. These things are very difficult to predict. But even if the Russian military is able to take this part of the Donbas, right, these successes are not decisive losses for Ukraine, ultimately. And the Russian military is likely to pay a substantial price in trying to gain this territory.
And so longer term, as you say, a war of attrition, that's what both militaries have to fight. What's going to determine Russia's ability to sustain that fight?
You know, at the end of the day, these wars often come down to manpower, material, who's able to replace their losses the best, who's able to adjust and build a force that can sustain the conflict. Both sides have significant challenges. The Russian military enjoys a local advantage, particularly advantage in firepower or artillery in the Donbas. The Ukrainian military right now is in a bit of a valley in terms of equipment and capability. It's slowly trying to assimilate Western equipment, artillery, and trying to change the kind of equipment and munitions that the force depends on. So this is a very challenging time for the Ukrainian military, probably the coming 2 months in particular. That said, the Ukraine somewhat enjoys long-term advantages in this war that is conditioned on sustained Western support, because Ukraine has the manpower, and if it has access to Western military equipment and training to use that equipment, over time, it can develop significant advantages.
Ukrainian officials are talking about launching counteroffensives against the Russian forces using those heavier weapons that you just talked about. How will those weapons affect Ukraine's ability to re-seize territory that Russia's occupied, if at all?
Western military equipment, particularly different types of artillery systems, will help equalize the current substantial disadvantage that Ukraine has relative to the massed Russian artillery firepower. That said, right now, both forces are only kind of capable of localized attacks. Ukraine has been conducting small localized counteroffensives in other parts of the front, trying to set themselves up in a better position down the line. Neither military really has the force capacity left for big offensives or breakout attacks, the kind of things that can generate momentum, right? Nor is either military close to collapse. Over time, Ukraine may be in a position to conduct a substantial counteroffensive, perhaps in one of the other regions like Kherson. But that doesn't just depend on military equipment. People tend to fixate on military equipment, on technology and capabilities. They make a significant difference. They are rarely game changers. You have to look at the quality of the force, and you have to look at the overall military.
And so do you believe that on the Russian side, they can wage the same kind of war they've been waging in the East indefinitely?
Well, indefinitely is a very hard test to pass. I'm not sure anything can be waged indefinitely, but the Russian military is playing to its strength, leveraging massed artillery firepower, right, which minimizes the disadvantages and problems it has in the force, and taking territory incrementally. Yes, they can sustain it for quite some time. But they, too, have big challenges when it comes to manpower, the sustainment of this fight, and the solutions they've taken to keep the Russian military in the fight and what is likely to be a protracted war have their own drawbacks. They come at the expense of long-term degradation of the Russian force. So they may not be that sustainable if we put it into a much longer timeline.
Michael Kaufman, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me back on the program.
The war in Ukraine has forced more than 5 million refugees to flee to other parts of Europe, with more than 700,000 of them seeking refuge in Germany. The tangible sufferings of the war aside, there is a hidden cost they have to bear, that of trauma. This is especially true of the youngest refugees. In partnership with the Global Health Reporting Center, special correspondent Will Wintercross reports from Berlin. And a warning. There's a discussion of suicidal thoughts in this story.
I've never felt this way before, when you don't know what's going to happen, like, in a month, what you're going to do with your life, where you're going to go.
Valeri escaped Zaporizhia in southern Ukraine in early March, when Russian troops began bombing nearby. He arrived in Berlin and was sent to the Northunder Hostel, currently home to 50 children and their mothers, all Ukrainian war refugees. It is run by AWO, a major German charity which helps the children find places in German schools and, critically, get psychological support. 8-year-old Daniela Zhukovskov fled Ukraine in early March as the fighting intensified.
When there were explosions, we sealed the windows with adhesive tape so that fragments would not hit us.
11-year-old Maria Samolenko also escaped the war.
The thing I miss most in my city right now is my dad, and I really miss his love and care right now.
I miss my home, my dad. I was very sad that he had to stay back.
What would you do now if you saw your dad?
I would have to cry from joy. It's like my country. I have half a feeling that it will win and half a feeling it won't.
And if it doesn't win, how will you feel?
Research shows that extended separation from a parent or caregiver is one of the most stressful things a child can experience. And of course, so is war. Stresses accumulate. For children like Maria and Daniello, the impact is mental, physical, and potentially lifelong, says Melanie Eckhart, a German psychologist.
From research and as psychologists, we know that the long-term effects are really, really bad if we don't get immediately help at the point after traumatization. Long-term effects can be, for example, sleeping disorders, depression, anxiety, up to really intense feelings of suicidality or even suicide attempts.
But this harm is not inevitable with the right help. Eckhart, who co-founded ChristenChat, a 24-hour crisis hotline, added Ukrainian-speaking counselors to her organization to help the newcomers.
We extended our platform and worked with our network together to set up very quickly crisis help for young people who are directly affected by the war in Ukraine.
The hotline is part of a broader German effort to help what sometimes seems like an overwhelming number of new arrivals. This reception center here in Berlin has processed over 300,000 Ukrainian refugees so far. A quarter of them have been children, many of which have been suffering from severe mental trauma. Barbara Brewer, from the main charity helping Ukrainian refugees at Berlin Central Station, explains that they learned from the Syrian refugee crisis that integration doesn't happen by itself.
We have to help people. It shows them we see you, we are here for you. We've got open ears, open arms, and I think that's the first thing that you have to do.
Brewer points out why rapid integration is so key to helping vulnerable children.
So that they don't get depression, that they have something to do, that they find friends, even if it's not for long, maybe for a year or as long this war may last, they should feel at home for this time and not be afraid and feel homesick all the time.
In the Syrian crisis, Germany was very slow to integrate the children into the German system of school, for example. Now we are much more fast, and it's very important that we are fast to integrate the Ukrainian children into the normal system, because they all experience kinds of trauma.
Mara Azerbi escaped Syria for Berlin with her family when she was 10 and also went straight into the German school system.
What I think was very well done was I was put in a Willkommensklasse, which is like a welcome class. And it's supposed to teach you German, integrate you into the German school system. And we all got along very well. It's my happiest memory is that first year in Germany.
Mada and her younger sister, Julia, who is 15, had their home bombed in Syria and witnessed their father being arrested by the secret police, a fate that often ends in execution. Their father spent 60 days in solitary confinement.
I realized my dad's laptop is in the back seat, and I was 100% sure that if they found this, then they'll take him for good. And so I went to the back seat and I sat on the laptop, which was in a bag. And I told Julia to sit on my lap so that they wouldn't see anything.
Julia describes the effect this had on her.
At least for the first 2 years in Germany, it was very difficult for me to adapt, I think. Simple things could trigger like me crying or me running away from things. When I would see people wearing military clothes, for example, or if people seemed suspicious, and I would think that the secret police found some sort of way to travel to Germany and get us.
The old fear hasn't disappeared.
This is just one of the events that probably caused me to feel ostracized and wanting to put up a fight every time I spoke to someone and just constantly trying not to get hurt.
I returned to the hostel to find out how Daniello and Valeri were getting on.
As long as I don't think about it, I feel very good. But when I start thinking about Dad, I feel very bad.
Of course, it's great that I'm in Berlin, not in Ukraine right now, under bombings, sitting in the basement. Of course, it is great, but still, it's really hard to adapt.
As 2,000 Ukrainian refugees continue to stream into Germany per day, it's clear the authorities have their work cut out. And as for the young recent arrivals, it's a new house, but not necessarily a new home, yet. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Will Wintercross in Berlin.
The classic American musical, The Music Man, has been a big hit this year with its revival on Broadway and on many regional and local stages across the country. John Yang went to see a novel take on the standard and how art can be a model for a more inclusive society. Note that American Sign Language interpreting was done simultaneous to the interview. That live process may affect the complete accuracy of the English interpretation. This story is part of our arts and health coverage on Canvas.
76 strong boys led the parade.
The spirited musical numbers, the sly scam, the Midwestern Americana. All the familiar touches of The Music Man are on display in this production at the only theater center in Maryland.
Remember, my friends, what a handful of trumpet players did to the famous fabled walls of Jericho.
But take a closer look. This isn't your grandfather's River City. It's envisioned as a place where the deaf and hearing communities live side by side, and not being able to hear isn't a barrier. Half the cast is deaf or hard of hearing. There were see-through COVID masks so the non-hearing actors could read lips and facial expressions. American Sign Language interpreters were positioned across the stage. The set was created by a deaf designer with a minimum of stairs so deaf actors don't have to take their eyes off their signing castmates. And a special lighting system let the non-hearing cast members know when there was a problem.
It's going to be a surtitle screen, which will be particularly helpful for those in the balcony.
Jason Lowith is in his 10th year as artistic director at Olney, one of the country's leading regional theaters. His philosophy? Let the art lead.
We heard there's a pool table in town.
The words are almost nonsense, but listening and watching the words be translated into ASL was revelatory. I thought this is a brilliant new way to experience the musical. And then, of course, our desire to create a community that is more inclusive by doing theater that is more inclusive. You know, it felt like the sky was the limit.
He wasn't quite so enthusiastic about 6 years ago when first approached by James Cabberley.
So it was akin to Frankenstein's monster approaching the scientist and saying, make me a new wife, right? Same concept, I think, in my pitch. But I would say that the pitch itself was different.
Never mind pumping any water till your parents are caught.
Deaf from birth, Cabberley was working as a carpenter in the theater's scenery shop. After seeing Deaf West Theater's production of Spring Awakening on Broadway, he went to Lowith with an idea.
Let's do The Music Man. Let's do this. And I don't think that he was totally convinced on the idea at the moment. It took a few, maybe three odd years of really pursuing it to convince him. Hey, 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 The Music Man. Hey, don't forget, The Music Man.
With a capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool.
The Music Man is an American musical theater classic. It tells the story of Harold Hill, a charming traveling salesman in early 20th century Iowa, who dupes townspeople into buying instruments for a non-existent children's band. Marion Peru, the town piano teacher and librarian, sees through him immediately, but then begins to see another side of him. By the time the final song is sung, they've each been transformed by love.
What I really wanted was, let's shatter that perception that disabled people can only play roles that are designed or written for disabled people.
Oh, we got trouble. We're in terrible, terrible trouble.
The world that is River City and The Music Man is a perfect choice for that.
After testing the idea in a 2019 workshop with a hearing actor as Harold Hill, another twist. What if he was deaf?
So if you compare Harold Hill as a hearing man, he's selling musical instruments. That's believable. He doesn't have to work additionally or extra hard to convince people that he could lead a musical band. Now, a deaf Harold Hill is a different story. He's a guy who really has to turn it up, really become a charmer to be able to convince a community of people that, hey, you should buy these musical instruments because guess what? I can lead a musical band, right? Ha ha. So I think it amplifies the character in a way, and you have to really, really increase that art of deception.
It makes Harold Hill not only the ultimate con man in a way, but also what you were saying before, the ultimate salesman of dreams.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Caverly, fresh from his breakout role in Hulu's Only Murders in the Building, was cast in the lead role. Artistic director Loweth estimates this production cost about 40% more than a traditional staging. Among the added expenses, the dozen sign language interpreters, a director of artistic sign language, or DASL, and two directors, one hearing, one deaf. The deaf director is Sandra May Frank, a star of the 2016 Broadway revival of Spring Awakening. She wanted this staging to be different.
I wanted to include American Sign Language, but I didn't want it to be anything that I'd seen done before. We've had deaf and hearing mixed productions in the past, but they're usually shadow hearing individuals voicing for deaf individuals speaking their lines in English. And actors would then sometimes simcom, which is speaking and signing at the same time, speaking English and signing at the same time. And that's very commonly what you see in the world of theater. And with this, I wanted to do something different.
So while all musical numbers are sung aloud, some scenes have dialogue only in sign language, with supertitles to aid hearing audience members. For Frank and director of artistic sign language Michelle Banks, who had the same job for this year's Broadway revival of For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough,
watch for telltale signs of corruption.
It's that combination of signed and spoken words to tell a story that's both groundbreaking and promising.
This is not just a one-off. This is not just for the arts. This can be a part of who we are as a humanity, as society, that this is how we can interact and engage with each other, to look at one another fully, completely, as our intersectional identities present, how we each navigate the world. Yes, this is beyond theater.
You have to attend to the show. You may not know what's coming next, but you're going to constantly have to be attuned. And your eyes, it's going to be a lot to absorb, right? Your eyes are a muscle and they may feel stretched, but that's what the experience should be.
Do you hope directors, producers, and casting directors will take something away from this too?
Absolutely. My hope is that through this, this is not the last.
It's you on my pillow.
As this diverse cast of actors unites their voices and hands in harmony. The show is to run through July 24th. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang in Olney, Maryland.
What a treat, and let's hope we see a lot more just like it. And now, an update to the Highland Park shooting. The suspected shooter has been charged with 7 counts of first-degree murder. The Illinois prosecutor says that he will also ask a judge to hold the suspect without bail, and more charges are expected to be filed. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.